Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals are provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information. The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chimanchu. I'm joined tonight by Sam Mazur, my co-host, as well as Dr. Callie Marshall. Hello.
Hello.
All right, our guest tonight is Dr. Kim Schemel to discuss the care of the well baby in the newborn nursery. But first, Sam, do you want to remind us what this podcast is all about?
I would love to, Chris. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Kim Schemel. Kim Schemel is a pediatric hospitalist and self-proclaimed newborn nerd at WashU Medicine in St. Louis. She splits her clinical time between the academic hospital, aka the Big House, and affiliated community hospitals. She spends far too much time following politics and fantasizing about newborn resuscitation. She is a mom to 3 nearly grown sons and 2 teen/tween stepdaughters, and wife to Paul, who tolerates her crazy and still brings her coffee. She is excited to be a Cribsiders guest.
All right, guys, time to deliver the main content.
Ooh, I get it.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Schemel. Because we're an informal group, is it okay if we call you by your first name?
Please do. Please. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. We just want to start with some rapid fire questions just to get to know you a little better. Can you give our audience and our listeners just a little bit about yourself and maybe something out of medicine that you like to do?
Sure. I'm Kim Schemel. I'm a pediatric hospitalist at WashU Med in St. Louis. Been there about almost 21 years now. I do a ton of newborn, which is my favorite thing to do. I may have been accused of being a little bit of an adrenaline junkie because the single best part of my job is resuscitation. And while I never wish for a baby to need resuscitation, if they do, I am your girl. The rest of the time, I am raising children and chasing pets and just trying to kind of keep our lives in line.
I tell you, you know, back from my residency, you know, working newborn unit was always like this crazy dichotomy. It's like, oh yeah, you know, we're just, you know, follow a couple of billies, do a couple of newborn exams when they pop out, and otherwise it's fine. But then you have that really scary one, you know, our call rooms were like right across in the newborn unit, and there was a special red phone that would call if OBGYN needed peds there. And of course, you know, I still have, it's an old fashioned phone, so I still have like bad PTSD from the ring of that phone that you could hear it from your call room at like 3 o'clock in the morning. It's like, oh no. But you know, then of course, then 99% of the time, there isn't much resuscitation either. So it's always that 1% that still scares me really bad.
I have that same PTSD from a number of different sounds, including the sound of ventilators at night in the NICU when I was a resident. So
yeah, some people need to be the resuscitation junkies and the adrenaline junkies. And some of us can, you know, graduate through that portion of our training and feel very happy that we've made it to the other side.
What is the best advice you've ever received as a learner or even like as a teacher or in your career?
Never trust a baby.
Ooh, I like that.
Never, brilliant. Never, ever trust a baby. Say they are cute. They are sweet. Most of the time they smell kind of good, but they are deceptive, inherently untrustworthy people.
So true.
They are all well babies until they're not. So you never, ever turn your back on them. And if you just remember that, you will be burned less frequently. Let me say that.
Yes. And that's nature versus nurture. That's a nature thing, it sounds like.
Dude, that's just a fact.
Yeah, straight up. Just come out. Do not trust you.
Mm-hmm. Precisely. But that persists well into their teen years and perhaps even their early 20s.
Now that one could flip a little bit, nature, nurture. We'll figure that one out.
True.
Should we get into it then?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
If you've ever listened to a heart murmur and thought, did I really hear that? You're not alone. I've had moments in the wards where I thought I caught something subtle, maybe a faint gallop or an irregular rhythm, but with background noise, a restless patient, and no time for a second opinion, I just had to move on. That's where Echo Health came in. Being able to record the sound meant I could revisit it later, and with the help of Echo's AI, I got confirmation that what I heard wasn't just in my head. It's like having a second set of expert ears, even after you've left the room. So Echo combines the stethoscope you already know with enhanced audio and advanced AI to help you detect heart and lung conditions earlier, and with more confidence. With Echo, you can hear with precision, even in noisy environments. Their digital stethoscope amplifies heart and lung sounds up to 40 times, and noise cancellation cuts out distractions. You can also detect disease earlier, unlock murmur and AFib detection powered by Echo AI, along with sound recording sharing and more for earlier diagnoses and seamless collaborations. And lastly, it improves diagnostic accuracy. Backed by millions of heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for devices and AI algorithms, clinical studies show that those who use Echo are 2 times more likely to detect heart disease. And a personal benefit? Teaching. I've used Echo recordings to walk learners through abnormal heart and lung sounds, and even to help patients better understand what's going on with their own bodies. It turns the stethoscope from a black box into a real-time teaching tool. So we trust Echo so much that we worked with their team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get up to $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/cribsiders. Your purchase may be HSA and FSA eligible and may also qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you'll detect heart and lung conditions more confidently. And if you don't, return it for a full refund. So again, go to echohealth.com/cribsiders for up to $50 off, plus a free chest piece cover. That's ekohealth.com/cribsiders.
Okay, you are called to the delivery of a term baby due to maternal SSRI use. Mom is a G2P0 with no additional medical problems and negative serologies. A healthy baby boy named Malik is born via uncomplicated vaginal delivery. He cries upon delivery and he's placed on mom's chest after 60 seconds of delayed cord clamping. Mom shares that she desires to breastfeed and asks for advice about initiating breastfeeding. So can you tell us a little bit about this kind of first hour of life and what practical recommendations you might have for a mom, especially one who wants to breastfeed?
So that first hour is actually really critical. We call it the golden hour, which is a little bit different than the golden hour that our NICU colleagues think about, which is the first hour of a preterm baby's life where they are trying to get some things settled. For a term baby or a healthy late preterm baby, that first hour, we call it the golden hour because it really is a transitional time for baby and for mom. So in your perfect state, that baby goes to what is sort of their natural environment, which is mom's chest. And that's got sort of a number of benefits for both of them. People like to refer to that time as bonding, which I don't really love that term because it sort of implies that if you don't do it, you're not bonded to your child, which is absolutely not true. But it does have some sort of intrinsic hormonally driven sort of bonding hormones. So one thing that happens when you put a baby on mom's chest is there's a lot of oxytocin being released. And oxytocin, you know, the lay public like to call that the love hormone, but it really does engender feelings of love and attachment between mother to baby. The other thing is that first hour for babies is very, very instinctive. So while they are skin to skin with mom, they are trying to regulate their blood sugar, because they're going from an environment where they've had just had a continual infusion of sugar through the placenta forever. They're now out and that's not happening anymore. So the baby's trying to kind of regulate and keep their own blood sugar in check. At the same time, they've come out of an environment that should be around 98 degrees and they're in now a 70 degree environment and they're trying to regulate their temperature. Being on mom's chest clearly helps them both of those things. So babies who are skin to skin with mom have an easier time regulating those blood sugars and maintaining their temperatures in a normal range. Now, if you think about it from a breastfeeding standpoint, babies have just run a marathon. They literally have just run a marathon and they're born and they're kind of tired. So when you place that baby on mom's chest, they will usually settle right down, stop crying, and they'll take a little bit of a rest. And if you leave them to their own devices, over the next usually hour, they will go through these, they are these nine like distinct instinctive phases. And if you let them be and watch them, they will do it. And over that hour, they will rest and they'll wake up and they'll kind of wiggle a little bit and kind of inch their way up on mom's chest. And then they'll rest a little bit. And they use all of their senses, particularly their tactile, their olfactory, their visual, to really get close to the breast, find it. And the healthy term ones will actually latch themselves on. Now, I can't say that's always true for our ones who are early, but they will generally do that. And we know that that early skin-to-skin time actually has some impacts on mom's long-term milk supply. Those babies have a higher success rate at breastfeeding, and they have a longer period of exclusivity with breastfeeding. So it's important. It's helpful. We know that babies who get off to the right start with that generally have a little bit easier time in the next day or two. That's not to say if it can't happen that it's all is lost. It's certainly not. But it is a way to really sort of optimally promote those feeding behaviors. Even for babies who are going to be formula fed, it promotes those feeding behaviors. And generally speaking, after that first hour, they might feed well again one time. Then they're like, I'm done. I'm going to sleep. I ran my race. I had my post-race snack. And for about the next 18 hours, they could not care less what's going on. So sometimes after that first feed, the babies won't eat and the parents really kind of get very uncomfortable with that. So it's helpful to be able to say, look, your baby knows what he's doing. This is normal. They're supposed to work really hard at being born. They're supposed to eat for a little while, and then they're going to rest and recover just like you are. Give them a little time and they're going to wake up and go do normal baby things.
After an hour of skin to skin with mom, Malik is weighed and given his newborn prophylactic medications, then unswaddled to prepare for his first newborn exam. He's in the 8th percentile for weight, 20th percentile for length, and 25th percentile for head circumference. So, Kim, when you examine a newborn baby, can you walk us through like a systematic approach that you use and any maybe pearls for a successful newborn physical exam?
Sure. So the key here is naked. This should be the most complete exam of a baby's life. And ideally you do that more or less naked. Now, also ideally you do that under the warmer. And I like it under the warmer for a couple of reasons. One, cold stress is not good for babies. But two, when they're under that warmer, they tend to not cry and fuss so much. So they have a little bit easier exam. So you want to unwrap them so you can see the entire baby. Exam-wise, really, it's what does this kid look like as a whole? Are they pink? Do they look comfortable? Are they having problems breathing? What's their muscle tone look like? Are they fussy and frantic, or are they just kind of chilling out under the warmer, hanging out, getting a little suntan there? And unlike adults, where we kind of teach people start at the top and work your way down, that tends not to work well for children in general, but especially for babies. So if I've got a quiet kid, I start with the heart and the lungs. Heart and the lungs, because once you get them amped up, good luck getting them quieted down again. So we'll usually start heart and lungs, and then I kind of go back to the top and then work my way down. So looking at their head, babies have some funny, goofy-shaped heads when they're born. So there's a lot of variations in normal here, and that's one of the things that parents will get a little freaked out about. So this first exam is actually a really good opportunity to teach parents about their baby and all the things their baby can already do. But starting at that head, looking at their head, looking at their eyes, looking at their ear position, checking their palate, then kind of moving visually down over, past the chest and check their belly. So they have bowel sounds. Do you feel a liver? Do you feel a spleen? Do you feel any masses? I'm going to drop the diaper. I usually try to actually check their pulses first, because once you get them angry and then start kicking their legs, that's a little bit harder to feel them. So we'll check their pulses. Then we'll do their hip exam to make sure those hips are well seated. Usually at that point, I kind of look at genitals, and then I will usually pick the legs up and actually look. Just, you want to make sure the baby actually has a patent anus, obviously, but it's also a nice time to look and see if there's any kind of sacral dimple. Usually work my way down the rest of their legs, and then I kind of go back up, check collarbones, because that's a nice bone that likes to get broken when babies are born sometimes. Check their upper extremity reflexes, and then I flip over and we'll look at their back. Sometime in there, I want to look at their eyes, but this is kind of a game time decision. If their eyes are open, I'm going to try to get a look. If the kid's super swollen and puffy and there's eye ointment all over the place, we may defer that until another day, but it's always easier to get a look at eyes if they open them on their own rather than us trying to sort of pry them open. Just some other tips and tricks. Babies are going to get fussy when you do these things. So having, you know, for a breastfeeding baby, ideally just a gloved finger for them to suck on. If family wants to use a pacifier, that's fine. But we generally try to delay pacifiers for babies who are learning to breastfeed. So giving them a finger to suck on to sort of calm them. If you need to, you know, swaddle part of them. So either wrap part of their body in the blanket or alternatively just bring their arms and legs in towards their core. It's called containment. Babies really don't like this sensation of having no boundaries. So when you pull those arms and legs in close to the body, they tend to settle and you'll have an easier time getting an exam. Sometimes you just got to pick them up and sway with them and rock and then try to listen to their heart that way. So it is all about trying to get a calm, cooperative baby.
Kim, you taught me how to do a good hip exam, I think, when I was an intern. And I remember I don't think I was doing it correctly until you really showed me what it means to do the hip exam. Can you kind of explain, you know, when we do the Ortolani and Barlow, what are the two specific maneuvers that we're looking for? And then, like, what is abnormal?
So what I tend to see when people check hips is they either do this for range of motion thing where they take the legs and they move it all the way through the range of motion, or they'll push down and then take the pressure off and then abduct to the side. The issue is that most children who have hip dysplasia do not have hips that are just frankly dislocated. They have hips that are subluxable. They'll still slip a little bit. So to do these, you've got to get that femur really at like a 90 degree angle with the bed. Push straight down into the bed, and then without letting that pressure up, then abduct and push in just a little bit with your long finger. And that's when you're going to feel that clunk. So if you just push down and then take the pressure off, the muscles are going to pull that femoral head right back in where it was. You're never going to feel that clunk. And it is a trick to learn to do. It is a practice thing. And it's one of those things that the first time you feel a real clunk, you go, ew, because it does not feel normal. A little bit like a clavicle fracture. Big ew moment.
And speaking of hard exams to do in that area, another one I find is the pulses of a young infant. I was just curious if you had any tricks or to just hope for the best.
Be patient, be gentle.
Yeah, okay. That's fine. I just didn't know from years of experience if there was something special.
You know, there's the little groove in between the muscles that I'm sure all of my ortho friends could tell me exactly which muscle they were, but there's the little groove, and if you put your fingers in there, and then you have to be gentle with the pressure, because if you push hard, you're just going to obscure the vessel, you're going to miss it. And if you're not in the right spot, don't put your fingers and move them. Just slide the skin just a millimeter or two kind of back and forth until you find it. But there are still days that I stand there and I'm like, have I lost all sensation in my fingers? What's going on?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I do have one more question too, as we brought up with the head exam. As you said, all the different shapes and sizes and all the different things, however birth may have come about. Would you mind sharing what you would consider abnormal in the newborn? Like something that's a problem because it's going to be in lots of different ways.
On the first day, there is very little that I have seen that has been abnormal. Now, clearly, if you are missing a piece of scalp, obviously not okay. Thankfully, we don't have a lot of surprises like that anymore. You know, generally see big surprises. But almost any shape in a newborn can be normal. So your kids who are breech, their head looks like a football. you know, the vaginal delivery from a particular first-time mom, they're like a total conehead. If you've had a couple of kids sort of packed in there, like, you know, shipping boxes, they'll come out with their head off to the side and kind of flattened on one side. There are not a lot of shapes that I would consider totally abnormal on at the time of birth. I almost always give them a solid 24 to 36 hours before I start going, huh, that might be a little bit abnormal. There is one that I that definitely requires some attention of. They've got a subgaleal hemorrhage. That is a biggie. The majority of subgaleal hemorrhages are small and nothing happens, but it is the one sort of head finding that can go south really, really fast. Babies can basically bleed to death into that subgaleal space quickly. So that I would say is the one thing that I'm just like, you got to have your eye on that.
And can you then explain to us a little bit of what that looks like? We can all Google it, but if we are not in that moment and you're right here listening to our show, would you mind just describing what that looks like?
Sure. So subgaleal bleeds are, they're basically a collection of blood sort of under the deep layers of the scalp skin, but outside the bone. And unfortunately, it's a free space. Like there's not boundaries to it. It extends basically from here, you know, right above your eyes, eyebrows, all the way back to the nape of the neck. And when babies start bleeding into that space, the bleeding may not stop. When you feel it, it has what we call a fluid wave. So if you kind of jiggle it, you'll literally see this wave of fluid. Feels like, I always say it's like a Ziploc snack bag full of water. It feels sloshy, almost. Sloshy and boggy.
Fall always feels like a reset. Between busier schedules and shorter days, finding the time to cook can be really tough. That's why I use Factor. Factor makes it easy to eat well without the stress of meal prep. Their meals are chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, and ready in just 2 minutes. For me, that's huge. I often don't have much time in the hospital, and Factor lets me skip the chopping, cooking, and cleanup while still eating something satisfying. I also love their vegetarian meals, especially the pastas. They're comforting, filling, honestly some of my go-tos when I need something fast but delicious. Factor also gives you more variety each week, from Mediterranean diet meals to GLP-1-friendly options and even premium seafood like salmon and shrimp at no extra cost. And now you can try new bold global flavors too. No matter your routine, you'll find something that works. And with Factor, you can save time, eat well, and actually look forward to your meals, even on the busiest days. So here's the deal. Eat smart at factormeals.com/cribsiders50off and use code cribsiders50off to get 50% off your first box, plus free breakfast for 1 year. That's code cribsiders50off at factormeals.com for 50% off your first box, plus free breakfast for 1 year. Get delicious, ready-to-eat meals delivered with Factor. Offer only valid for new Factor customers with code and qualifying auto-renewing subscription purchase.
And the difference as far as the feels go between a cephalohematoma and this is that one stops at a certain line. Is that correct? Versus the other one continues all the way from the front to the back. Is that correct? Am I missing something there?
No, you've got it. So, Okay. You know, cephalohematomas are bleeding under the periosteum, sort of the skin of the bone. So you can only bleed over up to the edges of that bone. And usually it's usually on one side of their head or the other, unless you've got an unlucky kid who's got two of them and looks like got horns, which is kind of entertaining.
Yes.
Fun to explain to parents. Whereas, you know, a subgaleal will be almost anywhere. And the truth is they're not always there in the delivery room right away. So if you've had a baby who's had a vacuum-assisted delivery and they've had a little bit of shearing of that layer off the bone, it may not be big enough to even see for several hours. Subgaleals may look fine in the delivery room, and then 3 or 4 hours later, you get called saying, hey, this, can you come look at this baby's head? So they're not always there right away. Gotta be, I guess, conscientious and willing to go look when somebody says, hey, this looks funny to me.
Before we move on to like other things outside of the physical exam, I want to ask, is there anything else that you'd like to take note of when you're sort of looking at the baby as a whole, the infant as a whole? Are there skin findings? Are you trying to like note, oh yeah, I see a dermal melanocytosis there. I see you're looking out for tufts of hair, you know, like what, like, are there any other major things that you see commonly that you try to take note of?
I mean, I guess at this point in my career and having taken care of, you know, a large population, infants of color, dermal melanocytosis is just, it's like saying, well, they've got, you know, two eyes. So I almost don't even notice it. But there are some things that are, you know, considerably more relevant. So sacral dimples in and of themselves, no big deal. Sacral dimples above the gluteal cleft, big deal. A kid who has like three or, you know, like long tufts of hair coming off of their spine, that's sort of a different thing. Yeah, there are some normal newborn rashes, pustular melanosis, that are, you know, kind of cool when you get to show your residents, and that's fun, but it's not dangerous. It doesn't particularly get your attention. Whereas lesions that look like blisters, say on a scalp, that might be more suggestive of a herpetic infection, that's the kind of thing that tends to get a lot of attention and needs to get a lot of attention really early.
Right. Since Malik is small for gestational age, you inform mom that we'll check additional blood sugars for him. What are other conditions that will put a baby at risk for hypoglycemia and will therefore require routine screening?
So your most well-known and common by far is an infant who's born to a mother with diabetes. That can be a pre-existing diabetic. She could be a type 1. She could be a type 2. She could be just a gestational diabetic. But all of those babies are at significantly increased risk of hypoglycemia. And usually that occurs within those first 12 hours of birth. The driving force between that form of hypoglycemia is that their insulin levels are basically turned way up. And once you, again, stop that continuous infusion of sugar through the umbilical cord, their blood sugars will drop like a rock. So the other causes of hypoglycemia are actually more related to having adequate stores of sugar, so glycogen. Babies like Malik, who are small, one of the more common reasons for babies to be small is that the placenta hasn't been working super spectacularly, and they're not growing really well. And for a baby who's not growing, Mother Nature doesn't pack away extra blood sugar to save for later when you're not growing well. So small babies like Malik or babies who are born early, so 35, 36 weeks, they just don't have enough glycogen stored up to kind of coast them through those next few hours. So they'll drop their blood sugar when they run out of sugar. It's like having a car and you get into trouble when you run out of gas. Now, if you leave the driveway with an eighth of a tank, you're probably going to run out of gas a lot sooner than if you had three quarters of a tank. So for those babies who are small or early, we generally watch them for a full 24 hours before we say, all right, we think they're going to get through this okay. A couple other things that are sort of less well known, but just as important, honestly, beta blockers. So we get a lot of moms who get beta blockers for preeclampsia. And there is some risk to those babies. The ones that are really at risk are when mom's on a chronic beta blocker. So somebody who's on, you know, Atenolol or Propranolol for a long period of time, those babies certainly can develop hypoglycemia, and they unfortunately won't necessarily show you symptoms because of the beta blockade. So they don't get jittery. They don't do funny things until they just seize on you. So those kids kind of deserve a little closer attention. Also, if mom's been on steroids, we even count if mom had gotten betamethasone for pulmonary maturation. We'll even count that. But the ones you really get concerned about, steroid-dependent asthmatic, a mom who, we actually have a lot of moms at our institution, at our academic center, who are walking around with organs in their body that weren't their own. So they're on steroids for immunosuppression. And they're, while we were very happy that they were able to have children, we think that's awesome, the steroids in that setting do raise that baby's risk of hypoglycemia. So those kids just get a little bit of extra attention for a little bit longer.
So when you say extra attention, like how often are you checking sugars, like with every feed, like every hour, like, and how would you decide how long you're doing that for, the entirety of their stay?
So different places will generally have different rules about this. Most commonly, we will use, you know, 12 hours for if baby's mom's diabetic, we will use 24 hours for most of the other indications. But I will say that is that they need to at least by the end of that screening period have gotten into what we would consider an okay range. So, you know, my blood sugar is probably running 70, 75, I hope. Newborn will run 40, 45, and that's okay. But you can't live at 45 for days. Usually we say by the time you hit the 24-hour mark, you should consistently be above 50. So we will check them for those for that first 24 hours. We won't stop checking until they're consistently over 50. Now, the thing about how frequent, this is the tricky thing about this. We generally say we want to check the baby before every feed for their for whatever the duration of that screening period, whether it's going to be 12 or 24 hours. That can be very tricky because some babies want to eat every couple hours for their first few hours, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they want to go 6 hours and they don't want to eat. So you sometimes get in the situation you kind of have to pick a random number. It's like if you're not ready to eat at the 3 hour mark after your last one, let's try to wake you and get a sugar. It is a little bit of a trick. Sometimes, particularly our younger trainees are like, well, I think it needs to be every 3 hours. And it's like, well, babies can't tell time. So I'm not sure how you expect them to, you know, look at the clock and say it's been 3 hours. That's just not kind of the way they work. It's the nurse's favorite thing to do is to try to play this game of when do I get the next blood sugar.
And any good tips or tricks that you would tell us that we should do or our listeners should do? It sounds like it's really hard. I was just wondering if there's anything that we should leave with, like, all right, you know what? Best shot is do this.
The best shot is to tell mom, call your nurse before you're ready to feed again.
Perfect.
That's the best option. Please tell us before when you're getting ready to feed, and we will come in and check the sugar then.
Excellent.
As a baby who is small for gestational age, Malik is at increased risk for hypothermia. So how would you explain to a family the importance of keeping a baby warm, and what practical recommendations from a clothing and swaddling standpoint do you have for helping these babies maintain euthermia?
Well, I actually find it really helpful to explain to families why they tend to have a struggle. So this is just like storing glucose before you're born. Babies store fat. And I don't mean the look at your chunky little, you know, 8-month-old baby thighs fat. I mean brown fat. That's what they use that's what they burn through to stay warm. Again, babies who are earlier, babies who are small, generally don't have good stores of that brown fat. And there's a way to explain this to parents in a way that seems to kind of make sense. But basically, I tell them, because we can't count on them to keep themselves warm, we've got to provide some support from the outside. That usually means a hat. The hat's very important. When you were 8 and you went out with a wet head and your mother told you you were going to catch pneumonia, I mean, you weren't going to catch pneumonia, but by golly, you sure lost a lot of heat through your head. So that hat's really critical, especially in those first 24 hours. We really have to reinforce, I want the baby to stay warm, but I don't want a lot of bulk. I don't want 3 or 4 blankets. So instead of multiple blankets, it's let's do the onesie plus a sleeper and then a swaddle, as opposed to adding more blankets on. And the thing I tell them is, listen, when your baby's spending all their energy trying to stay warm, they don't have the energy to eat. They use all the glucose they have to try to stay warm, and then their glucoses go low, and they don't grow. So it is one of the multiple pieces that kind of have to work together in conjunction to help a baby grow. You got to stay warm, you got to keep your blood sugar up, and you got to eat. If you can't do one of those things, we get into trouble.
So my question is also for the flip side for that young intern who's trying to balance this piece. Can you over clothe the baby and cause a fever? Is that possible? Should we be concerned about what we do then? Because we know that if we cause a fever in a 1 to 2 day old baby, we are in major trouble.
Ah, the bane of my existence. The nursery fever, not fever.
Yes, yes, that's what we're here to discuss.
Absolutely.
I hate this when this happens. Callie hates this when I send her a baby across the bridge who may or may not be sick. Yes, you know, if you've got some cultures in particular really value, they're very concerned about the baby, a baby getting cold. And they will put on layer upon layer and they will crank the heat up way in the room because that is culturally very important. And sometimes the kid will have, they'll have a fever. And we have a number of ways to kind of try to get around that. One is, all right, if we take the extra layers off, does this normalize pretty quickly? Does this baby otherwise look completely normal? Is their sepsis, you know, risk already pretty low? And I'm not sending the kid home like in an hour. We kind of try to avoid taking an environmental hyperthermia really and turning it into a fever. But sometimes the temperature is high enough, you just can't blow it off. If it happens more than once, you really can't blow it off. Probably long term, the more concerning thing is that over bundling a baby increases their risk of SIDS. So you are better off being a little bit cooler than a little bit too hot.
And I guess the one thing that I want to say, and you don't have to say this, answer this directly, like if we don't know, you don't know. Is there a specific number of clothes with which you would recommend to a baby to wear in your hospital in Cashlack, St. Louis?
Whatever you feel comfortable with, plus one layer. Which is what I tell parents all the time. Well, how much should I dress the baby in? All right, you're going out for a walk. Put the baby in whatever you're wearing and then add one more layer.
Perfect.
You know what? If they still feel cool after that, add a little more. If they feel a little too warm, take some off.
That's scientific enough for me. I like it.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, I tell parents all the time, there's like three rules to parenting and or to raising children, and then most of the rest of it's actually, you know, parenting choices.
So can we also screen all of our newborns for their risk of sepsis using the Kaiser Sepsis Calculator? So what factors play into this calculator, and how are you using the results in the monitoring and the management of a newborn baby?
Oh, can I extol the beauty of the Kaiser
yes.
Sepsis score?
Yes.
Because prior to the Kaiser sepsis score, we would have to put all these different pieces together of what was mom's temperature and how long was her membranes ruptured and do I need to get a CBC or should I get a blood culture and mom's got chorio and the baby looks good but the CBC looks lousy. Thank you, Kaiser, for removing some of the, I don't know, non-scientific basis for what we did. Let's just say that. So the Kaiser sepsis score takes a few things into account. Number one is the baby's gestational age, because the earlier you are, the more prone you are to infection. Looks at mom's temperature during labor, actually looks at her maximum temperature, includes how long were her membranes ruptured. So, you know, 20 minutes is a lot different than 20 hours. Then it looks at what is her group B strep status. Is she positive? Is she negative? Is it unknown? And then did she get antibiotic prophylaxis? And if so, what kind of prophylaxis was it? Did you have your regular old GPS antibiotics, but they got them in like 20 minutes before you delivered? Or did you end up with a much more broader spectrum? And it then kicks out numbers, like data-driven numbers, about what that individual baby's risk of developing early onset sepsis in the first 24 hours. Doesn't actually tell you anything after first 24 hours. It tells you the first 24 hours. And it stratifies the babies by, does this baby look well? Does this baby look healthy? That gives you one number. If the baby's doing a few funny things, okay, they've been breathing a little fast. They've been kind of tachypneic for 3 or 4 or 5 hours now, and that puts them in this equivocal category. There's a different score for that. And if the kid's just frankly sick, then that's sort of the lowest. That's the last number they give you. And the answer when they're sick is always treat them. The answer is always antibiotics. But it's really been helpful because it has taken a lot of the guesswork out of how long do I need to watch this baby in the hospital? How frequently do I need to do vital signs? Do I need to get labs? Can this mom go home in 24 hours when she wants to? It really has been, at least from this perspective of early onset sepsis, it's completely changed how we manage things in the nursery. It's just fantastic, and I love it, and I wish I could meet the Kaiser people and say thank you.
And, you know, I know it gives that different kind of options, vitals, blood cultures, antibiotics, and, of course, culture beforehand. The blood culture just on its own, is it just a single blood culture on its own and then just wait for the fever to come? Is that how that goes?
Yep.
Okay. Just to make sure.
Once they have a, you know, once they have a fever, like a real fever, or they have like two fevers, you're going down a whole different road. But I will also tell you this, babies are much more likely to get hypothermic than they are to get a fever. When babies get sick, they drop their temperatures. They don't, yeah, once they go home from the hospital, sure, they get fevers, but that's a whole different kind of medicine. In the nursery, they tend to drop their temperatures rather than get fevers.
Gotcha. And then we truly are just, though, just so everyone's clear, there is no CBC, there is no other test. It is the blood culture and an observation until something changes.
Generally speaking, yes. If you are not, the CBC just doesn't add a whole lot. And what the data has kind of come out and shown, first of all, the range of a normal white count on a newborn is like 5,000 to 35,000. Like the grown-up doctors are going, 35,000, oh my God. But, you know, that's just healthy baby bone marrow doing healthy baby bone marrow stuff. But what we found out is when you get the blood culture and you get the CBC and then you start making decisions based on what that CBC looks like, you end up over-treating tremendously. You have the most valuable piece of evidence right there in front of you. It's the baby. You have the baby. Look at the baby. Not at the number. That's the second best piece of advice I've ever gotten. Look at the baby, not the number.
And actually, my follow-up question was going to be exactly that. So what on earth is equivocal?
Equivocal is actually very clearly defined by Kaiser.
Okay, great. Please tell us.
Okay, so, well, you're going to make me do this from memory, huh?
Oh, no, we can look it up. You can look it up. We can read it off. Yeah, this is good.
We can put it in the show notes, too. Yeah.
Definitely.
So actually, if you go to the Kaiser Sepsis tool online and you open up exactly what equivocal says. It is vital signs that are abnormal for more than 4 hours. That's the one that really sticks in my memory.
Yeah. Oh, I just pulled it up right here.
Oh, good. See,
I will read it off. This is really
poor
form.
You read it off, Sam, because you're the one who put her on the spot for this.
Because I asked a question and then I'm reading off the answer. This is incredibly poor form. But no, I'm Googling it so everyone knows.
I look it up every time. Well, not every single time. Some things I'm like, I know that kid's been breathing 70 for 4 hours now. I'm done. But
that can't be good.
Kaiser even gives you a little bit of wiggle room on a temperature, on a fever. They'll give you a freebie if the kid otherwise looks good. You get one freebie.
So here's the equivocal. So number one is persistent physiologic abnormality greater than 4 hours. That's tachycardia greater than 160, tachypnea greater than 60, temperature instability either greater than or equal to 100.4 or less than 97.5. And then and the last one is respiratory distress, grunting, flaring, or retracting, not requiring O2. And then that's the 4 hour mark or the 2 hour mark. You can have at the 2 hour mark, you have two or more physiologic abnormalities lasting greater than or equal than 2 hours. And that's tachycardia greater than 160, as we said, the tachypnea greater than 60, temperature instability, as we mentioned, and the respiratory distress. So essentially, if you have two of them over 2 hours or one of them over 4 hours, that's then equivocal to then decide what to do. But of course, you're like putting this all together at the same times as it's coming through, it sounds like, and you're kind of making that decision by the time you get that blood culture, for example.
That is absolutely, you nailed it, Sam. That's exactly what it is.
All right.
Thank you for looking that up.
Yeah, no, this is, we're all learning here, me especially.
So conveniently, it's built into Epic. You cheat and look at it.
Because gotcha. I was wondering, like, I bet you, because I'm looking at the Kaiser Permanente calculator, and the first question is the incidence of early onset sepsis, and it gives you, it has Kaiser Permanente's, you know, 0.3 per thousand live births, whereas the CDC national incidence is 0.5 per thousand live births. I assume if it's built into your EMR, that's probably going to list at least maybe your local early onset sepsis percentage.
I wish we had that data. We haven't got that data for ourselves. We use the CDC national average. And to this day, I wonder, how does Kaiser have this very low sepsis rates? I do not understand, but I would like to adopt whatever it is they're doing out there.
And there's a piece of it too that asks about adequate prophylaxis for mom. I run into this every time, like, okay, which antibiotics are technically adequate, which aren't, because we'll see kind of different meds given to mom. Would you happen to know that, Kim, kind of which ones they count as adequate prophylaxis and which antibiotics do not count?
Penicillin, ampicillin, and enzafazolin. That's it. Nothing else counts as adequate.
Zvanc doesn't count?
Zvanc does not count. Okay. So you might say, why, pray tell, do our obstetrical friends give women vancomycin then? And the answer is, for a woman who has an IgE-mediated penicillin reaction, you can't give her any of those antibiotics unless you would like her to anaphylax. The only option you really have is vancomycin. And theoretically, you'd think, well, vancomycin's got, you know, kills pretty much everything gram-positive, right? Yes and no, right? But the issue is, we have no idea what the pharmacokinetics and the pharmacodynamics are of vancomycin in a fetus. For antibiotics to work, they've got to get in the mom, across the placenta, into the baby, and then peed out into the amniotic fluid. That's how you provide this sort of cocoon of protection around that baby. We have no idea how long it takes vancomycin to do that. We have data for the others.
Perfect. Thank you.
Oh, I do have one question. If you hit the equivocal level, does that automatically mean you feel that the baby needs to be observed at least for 48 hours?
No, not necessarily. If you do a blood culture and all of those abnormalities normalize, you maybe will be able to go home on time. It wouldn't necessarily keep you 48 hours after that. Most of us, generally speaking, though, would not discharge a baby who's going to have persistent physiologic abnormalities.
That makes sense.
There's a couple very specific situations where you might send home a baby who's tachypneic after you've ruled out a bunch of other bad things. Methamphetamine comes to mind, because it does tend to cause some tachypnea in babies sometimes. But again, you have to rule out all the bad things before you make that jump.
Malik successfully initiates breastfeeding. And by day two of life, Malik has had three voids and two dark stools. Mom's breastfeeding him every 2 to 3 hours. You note that he has lost 10% of birth weight, though. So what is the expected weight loss trajectory over the first 1 to 2 days of life? And how might this differ by method of feeding, method of delivery?
So the old number was you could lose up to 10% of birth weight, and that was fine. It's quite a bit more nuanced than that, honestly. So if you look at exclusively breastfed babies, the average weight loss is 7%. A lot of them will lose 8%. Once you kind of get that above 8%, it's sort of, well, let's look and see if, let's see how black breastfeeding is really going. Let's make sure lactation is taking a close look. Let's see, do we have actually some signs of milk transfer here? It doesn't mean you have to intervene and do anything, but 8% generally means we need to take a closer look here. Once sort of we hit that 10% mark, I wouldn't say the red flags go up, but you got to look a little bit closer. So by 10%, you can say, yeah, we're probably not getting enough to eat here. And you have to make a decision about supplementation. But sometimes that decision is her milk in now? So if I am sitting there 48 hours out, I've got a baby who's 10% down, but mom's milk is in, I may not, and my assessment is baby at breast is in fact transferring milk effectively. If those things are true, I may not do anything other than make sure they see their pediatrician the next day for a weight check. That said, if it's a, you know, mom who, it's her first baby, is 3 weeks early, doesn't feed very well anyway. You know, he's down 10% on day two or so. I know her milk's probably at least another 24 hours from coming in. That is a baby I might be more, a little more aggressive with supplementation with. So it really is, you have to put a lot of pieces together. So yes, babies who are delivered via C-section do lose more weight than babies who are delivered vaginally. And there's this handy dandy little thing out there called the NEWT tool, neonatal early weight loss tool, that has taken all that data and actually stratified it, you know, 50th percentile, 25th percentile, 75th percentile, for vaginal and for cesarean deliveries. So one of the things you can look at and say, all right, well, I don't really love this 9%, but you look and you see this is a C-section baby who's, you know, 72 hours out, and that's actually not that striking. So if that number looks good, milk seems to be on its way in, baby is voiding, baby is stooling, baby is not screaming his head off and showing persistent hunger cues at the end of a feeding, you can probably coast on that a little bit longer. But follow-up is the important thing. I mean, that is really the important thing, is if they are going home, you need early follow-up if you're on that cusp of how's this feeding going. And parents have to remember, these babies are waterlogged. Again, we're back to that continuous infusion, right? These babies are basically getting IV fluids continuously for 9 months. Then you suddenly cut them off and you start giving them feeds that are, you know, teeny tiny. People forget normal breast so colostrum feedings on the first day is about a teaspoon, maybe two. It's just not that much, but that's normal. That's physiologic. But of course they're going to lose some weight when you've been tanked up on fluids forever and now you're going hours without drinking a whole lot. And that's hard for parents to, particularly for mothers, to trust that process. I've always said 95% of breastfeeding is a psychological game, but it is very hard to trust that process when you see the number on the scale going down and you can't see milk and you can't feel milk. So support, you know, really supporting mom and trying to give her good explanations of what's going on and why it's happening really makes a huge difference.
And I do have a question about the new tool, because that seems fantastic. It seems like you're actually using it a lot more to essentially save people from supplementing, saying, hey, I think this is going to work out well. You know, actually look, you're on the expected curve, even though we have classic numbers, you're actually more on the curve that fits you. And plus your milk was coming in a lot of times to save people from those experiences. Can the new tool be used in any other way? Are you catching anything early or late that you would, early in one way or the other that you would also use? Or should we mostly think about it? How can we save this family from trying to supplement in some way?
And I don't want to, you know, act like supplementation is an evil thing or formula
right,
is terrible.
Right, of course,
clearly,
yeah.
It is not. It is one of many ways that loving, great parents feed their children. So I definitely don't want to bash formula in any way. Babies who are on that new tool and are really dropping percentiles. So when you see them crossing percentiles, it's just like a growth curve. Like, once you find your growth curve, you should kind of stick to it. If you are crossing percentiles on that tool, that's more concerning than a baby who's sitting there at, you know, the 70th percentile the whole time. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. And how often and how old can you use the new tool for, as far as like when they hit the general pediatrician's office, when they see us in clinic, can you still use that at the same time? Or is it really a newborn nursery kind of, you know, the 24 to 72 hours that they're staying?
There is an age on it, but I want to say it may go up even out to 7 days. I would have to look at it to tell you. Mm-hmm. I try not to keep babies in the hospital past day three.
Right. I had a feeling based on our conversation already. Yeah.
Off with you. Go. Yeah. Go find an outpatient pediatrician who really knows how to do this, because it's not me.
Fair enough. All right, Callie, next question.
Do you feel like you can never get ahead of charting? Imagine a world where you don't need to think about notes again. Introducing Freed, an AI medical scribe built to free clinicians everywhere. It listens, transcribes, and writes instant clinical notes for you in your style. Freed can be used across all specialties for in-office as well as virtual visits, and it works in multiple languages. Written in your style and ready the moment the visit is over, all you have to do is copy it into your EHR. Freed is HIPAA compliant and only takes seconds to learn. Over 15,000 clinicians, including doctors, APPs, therapists, use Freed to save up to 2 hours every day and free themselves from that documentation. Just imagine the great feeling of coming home without any notes hanging over your head. Get back to doing what you love and let Freed do the rest. And start your free trial today, no credit card needed. Use code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe. That's code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe.
So what scenario, you know, in that case, then might you recommend supplementation via formula or expressed breast milk? And like, how do you frame that with a family in this kind of emotionally charged time for them?
part where they're all them. And typically by this time, say that first 24 hours, right? The first night's great because mom and dad are still on this like birth high and they're like, this is great. We've waited so long. And then they go through the second night with that whole second night syndrome where the baby won't, you know, sleep. And now they're exhausted about day three, right? Now they're 10% down their weight. Their baby's not peeing. Their baby's not pooping. The milk is not in. The milk's not flowing, but the tears sure are. It is really helpful in that scenario to try to explain to the mom and the dad, but especially the mom, why are we where we are? Because you can usually pick it out. You can usually say, I would say the thing, there's two things I see the most. One, a late preterm or early term baby, usually, you know, 36, 37 weeks, who is trying to go to breast with a mother who is not breastfed before. Her milk's probably going to take 72 hours to come in. The baby does not wake frequently. The baby does not have a really strong suck when they are latched, and they fall asleep. They can't maintain the feed very long and they fall asleep. So they don't transfer a whole lot in terms of colostrum. And you know, the treatment for that is tincture of thyme. As they get closer to term, those feeding skills are going to become what they should be at 39 or 40 weeks. The answer in that scenario is we need to feed the baby until baby is big enough and strong enough to figure this out. For the mom who, so the other end of the spectrum, you know, we've got a 41 weeker, let's say. But again, first time mom, she came in, she got induced, she had a 36 hour induction, and then she labored, and then she ends up having a cesarean after pushing for 3 hours. And milk doesn't come in on day that's 72 hours like you would expect. And then you go to day four and it's still not there. And now it's day five. By this point, this kid's lost a lot of weight. The kid's probably not peeing or pooping anymore. The baby's miserable. The mom's miserable. The dad's miserable. And it's really helpful in that scenario to walk them through, okay, what's going on here? A first-time mom who delivers vaginally is usually going to have milk come in at 72 hours. A C-section will often push it back a day. A C-section after a long labor and pushing, sometimes it's day five. But that is not an indication that you're going to have a bad milk supply. It's late because of these things that have happened, but you will have an adequate milk supply. There is no reason to think that what's going on right now reflects what your milk supply is ultimately going to be. So the important thing in the meantime, number one, feed the baby. Number two, to protect the milk supply. And we have ways of feeding a baby that will not completely disrupt breastfeeding, but this is a bridge. And that's what I say in both of those categories, is this is a bridge. This is not a replacement. This is not a sign that breastfeeding is not going to work. It's not a sign that your milk supply is lousy or you're a bad parent or any of the other things that moms can go down the rabbit hole with in those first few days after delivery. This is a bridge to get you where we want you to be. And honestly, we're going to use, if mom's got some milk and we can pump some and give baby that, that's going to be our first go-to. If you're at a facility that has donor human milk, that's going to be our second best. If mom wants to go with formula, or formula is what your hospital can provide, then we'll do that. But we try to be very conscientious with how much should this baby be getting. And what is sort of our progression towards milk coming in? And do we have lactation fully engaged? And this is part of the reason, just going back to that whole golden hour thing, that early component is so important. Because when we don't do those early sort of intuitive things that we need to do, you end up chasing your tail a lot on the back and trying to kick up a milk supply that could have been stimulated more effectively on the front end. Other scenarios you're going to supplement in a baby who's repeatedly hypoglycemic. That's a baby you're probably going to have to supplement. A baby who maybe has a cleft lip, cleft palate, and may not be able to feed effectively at the breast. A lot of babies with neuromuscular things, sort of like Down syndrome, I would say is your classic one, that they just are not, they're hypotonic. They just don't feed well. Those kids are generally going to need some supplementation for a while. I would say the other thing that I see really commonly is women who plan to exclusively pump for their babies. They don't want to put baby to breast. They would prefer to exclusively pump, but don't realize that in those first 2 or 3 days, trying to pump is going to give you like drops of colostrum, which is not going to cut it. So for those moms, we use supplementary feeds until she's able to pump enough milk. That's a really, really common scenario that I see for a number of reasons that they may not want to put baby to breast.
And then, Kim, you talked about, you know, their stooling patterns and their voiding patterns. So kind of what do I expect from a baby over the first few days of life in regards to voiding and stooling to help assess kind of their hydration status and their feeds?
Expectations are low early on. You know, first 24 hours, we want to see one pee and one poop. Second 24 hours, we'd like to see two and two. You know, if by day four, we're having less than four stools, that's potentially an issue. And if you're still passing meconium on day five, now we got a problem. So those are ballparks, but you have to look at that in the overall picture. So that is a piece of information. You're also going to look at what's the weight doing. You're also going to look at what are the baby's feeding cues looking like. So what's the newt look like? So it is a piece of information. It's not the be all and end all. You know, even normal healthy babies can take up to 48 hours to pass meconium, still within the range of normal, although it makes all of us just a little bit anxious. So sometimes they don't. And if all the other parameters are reassuring, you can be a little bit patient with it.
Thank you. So I want to kind of shift, kind of thinking about, you know, going home and counseling families moving home. So I have kind of a few questions about discharge and thinking about, you know, leaving the nursery. So the first one is about like sleep environment. So if you find a baby in the hospital in an unsafe sleep environment, how are you counseling a family about the importance of safe sleep and kind of what that looks like going home?
It's really important to do that in a way to model and not to shame. It is not you are a bad parent. How could you have put your baby prone in this bassinet? It's, hey, let's talk about how we can make your baby as safe as possible when they sleep. Most families are really receptive to that. The thing that I find really challenging is families who are bed sharing, usually accidentally, but occasionally intentionally as well. You know, we tell families, well, when you're getting sleepy, put your baby in their own sleep space. And it's like, yeah, that's exactly what you're supposed to do. That's exactly what you're supposed to do. But the reality is there is nothing. I mean, the worst Q2 PICU call schedule in the world does not compare to what a newborn will do to your sleep. It is a bone deep fatigue. I don't know any mother who hasn't fallen asleep with that baby in her bed once or twice. It's not intentional. The big thing I think is to make sure she's got support. So having another person with her, that might be the baby's father, that might be the baby's other parent, that might be grandmother, that might be auntie, that could be a lot of people. Other cultures have this down pat where other family members take care of these babies while mom recovers herself. That's not sort of an American thing. We're kind of like, well, you need to be all things to this baby at all times. That's when unsafe sleep really tends to happen, is they get brought into the bed because the baby's fussy because there's nobody else to hold him or her, and then they fall asleep. And that happens in my hospital probably multiple times a week. I'm sure it happens more than we realize because we don't always see it. Reinforcing in that moment, here's what I need you to do. What kind of help can we get for you? Who else can help you with this baby? If you need to take a break and send your baby to the nursery, that is okay. We are all for 24-hour togetherness and moms being able to respond to their babies quickly. But this is about the couplet. Healthy mom, healthy baby.
You know, going home, counseling family, you know, some of the other things that happen before this baby will leave the nursery are a couple of screens. So how would you tell a family about the congenital, the critical congenital heart disease screening, and the hearing screen and the newborn screen that their baby will get before they leave the nursery?
Sure. I usually, with the critical congenital heart disease or the CCHD screening, explain it. This is a test that helps us rule out some of the really big, dangerous heart problems. We check the oxygen on your baby's hand and we check the oxygen on your baby's foot, and they should be pretty close together. That's a pretty simple thing to explain. The hearing screen, a little bit more complex, but not that much. We usually tell them we have two types. The one picks up most forms of hearing loss, and it tells us that everything from the ear canal all the way into your middle ear works. The other test tells us a little bit more. It tells us that everything between the middle ear and the brain works. So difference between OAE and ABR. And then, you know, the newborn screen, pretty basic explanation. I would say this tests for a lot of many, many different diseases, some of which are inherited, some of which are not, that are really, really dangerous, but don't show symptoms until after that damage has been done, which is why it's really important to do this. And that, you know, it will take weeks to get the formal results back. If there's something really concerning, you will hear about it sooner. And we do actually, this has been the new thing that's been really, really frustrating. We've had families refusing the newborn screen now, which I would say is up there with refusing vitamin K in terms of anxiety provoking. But that's one of the new ones that we've sort of started to run into a little bit. And sometimes it's because the parents just don't understand what it's for. And once you explain it, they can do okay. And others really believe that the risk is so low that they are comfortable skipping it. It's a hard conversation to have.
And we could delve into this for a while, but I do want to ask just for the provider side of this conversation, when do those things happen? Do what needs to be wait for 24 hours of life versus what can be happened beforehand? When do you generally order these three tests?
Well, if you're at most hospitals, it's ordered when they're admitted because they're standing orders. Yay.
Yes.
But they cannot. So CCHD and a hearing, CCHD and the newborn screen can't be done until 24 hours. They are not valid prior to 24 hours of life. The hearing screen you can do anytime in there, but waiting till closer to discharge is probably going to give you a little bit better chance of passing just because some retained fluid and stuff in the middle ear.
Awesome. And then as far as the newborn screen goes, what type of blood draw is that?
It's very interesting. It doesn't go in a tube. They draw actually like prick the baby's heel, and they actually put in these little card that has these little round circles, and they have to kind of perfectly fill the circle. Most often they do that with a little capillary tube, and they just prick the baby's heel and then use a little capillary tube to suck the blood up, and then they drop it on the little tab. It's apparently quite tricky to learn to do well.
Yes.
That's why I have so much incompletes that I have to repeat it.
Exactly. And Kim, you'd mentioned the difference between the two. Could you just remind which one is the OAE and which one is the ABR?
Yeah, the OAE is basically, and I would not generally explain it to families this way, but the OAE is a little probe that goes in their ears, sends out a series of clicks, waits to hear back the click from the click of the hair cells in the cochlea. So that tells you everything from the tip of that probe to the cochlea is open and functioning. It doesn't tell you anything about the acoustic nerve. So for those babies who are at high risk of sensorineural hearing loss, you need to do the ABR, which is also a cute little probe in their ear, but these little stickers on their forehead that say basically brain waves. It's like, yeah, it's brain waves that say, I hear that. Super interesting, but you know, in different states have different rules about this. Our state mandates you have to have a hearing screen, and the OAE is technically easier to do, and it is, the software is less complicated. It's cheaper, it's easier to troubleshoot. The ABR, that software is more expensive. It is prone to having some issues, so some hospitals will choose not to provide that, and that's going to be hospital specific based on state law, state requirements.
But an abnormal OAE should at least trigger an ABR test.
Correct. So any OAE fail needs to be followed up by an ABR. And if this hospital doesn't do it, then you've got to get them one outpatient. But yes. And we can usually reassure families, the vast majority of babies who do not pass their newborn hearing screen do go on to pass their hearing screen outpatient. But it's really important to be sure, because if your child has hearing loss, the best outcomes are when we can identify that early and start helping them with that early.
Awesome. So what criteria then does a newborn need to meet to go home with family?
You got to eat, you got to pee, you got to poop, you got to keep your vitals where they're supposed to be, and you got to have good follow-up. That's the quick and dirty version.
That's fantastic.
So you've got to, they have to show is what they call, you have to pass the test of life, as my friends call it. You have to show that you can eat enough to keep yourself fed. You have to show us that you can keep your temperature and your heart rate and your respiratory rate in a normal range for long enough to convince us that there's nothing wrong with you. Whether it's sepsis or you've got a lung problem or you've got an inborn error in metabolism, you got to show us enough time of good behavior, basically, that we are confident that you can go home for a little while without us watching you. You got to pee, you got to poop, you got to tell us that all those systems are open and intact, and you've got to have good follow-up. That is the biggest thing, is good follow-up. Once upon a time, mothers and babies stayed in the hospital for a week after you delivered. The mom's got a lot of help. You stayed in the hospital for a week. All those problems that we think about now were dealt with in the hospital. We don't do that now. They go home in 24 hours or 36 hours or 48 hours. They have to have someone to do that check in the next day or two to make sure things are still trending in the right direction. We cannot promise people we're going to catch every problem that that baby could have in the 24 hours we have them. Early follow-up, absolutely critical. Love our outpatient pediatricians for what they do.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. Is like, what is the bare minimum a baby needs to show you that they are stable? It sounds like 24, maybe? Can they go home even before that?
I will say that some places do. Usually they are more birth center type of environments. And it's not super uncommon. I will say in most hospitals, it is a minimum of 24 hours. I, again, don't trust newborns. I especially don't trust newborns with first-time parents who just don't have the benefit experience to know this baby is a sick baby, that baby's not. So very few babies in my experience can meet all their discharge criteria before 24 hours. Now, I will say in the places that do discharges earlier than that, who do it reasonably well, it is typically a midwifery model with midwives who are able to provide in-home evaluation the next day. Some of them will, sometimes they discharge as early as 6 hours. I cannot say that I think that is safe. But one of the advantages of the midwifery model is they tend to do in-home follow-up the next day. We do have some families at one of our community hospitals who are delivered by a group of midwives. They do stay till 24 hours, but they may not have their hearing screen. They may not have their newborn screen done before they leave because their midwife's going to do them when they get home. And as long as that follow-up's in place and it's a low-risk baby, we can work with that.
So in your expert opinion, as someone who's been doing this for quite a long time, let's take the first-time parent who just had a vaginal birth and who is otherwise doing average. When would you discharge that child?
I would keep that baby for 2 midnights.
2 midnights. There we go.
2 midnights. And it's because of second night syndrome, which if you don't believe that is a real thing, please Google it. It is a Googleable term. Parents always think they have the most pristine angel baby in the world the first night because some kids are zonked. They are tired. They mostly don't wake up. The next night, they're like, hey, guys, 2 a.m. is party time. Let's go. And by then, you're starting to come off that birth high and you're starting to feel the last 3 or 4 days. It is miserable the second night more often than not. And families really haven't gotten a taste of what this is really going to be like yet. So although I will not tell a family they cannot go home if they otherwise meet discharge criteria, I strongly discourage it.
I mean, is there also, especially when you're thinking about, there are 2 people in the hospital when this happens. Like what's the discussion like with OB? Because the mom may or may not have their own health issues. So the timing doesn't always work out with the baby. How does that work out?
Our facility, generally, if the mom's not being discharged, we keep the baby until she does. We see that a lot with preeclampsia and things where she needs a bit of a more prolonged stay. In those situations, it is the right thing to do to keep the mom and the baby together. So we do not discharge those babies in that situation. However, we do sometimes have the other situation where I have a baby that I don't think is ready to go home. And our obstetrician's like, mom's great. She can discharge. And then we have to have a convo.
Yeah. So on the day of discharge, each family receives some version of a discharge talk, kind of counseling them on what to expect before they see their pediatrician for follow-up, and then indications to seek medical care. Can you share with us the counseling you would give a first-time parent before going home?
So my bare minimums. I have a few bare minimums, and I thankfully am in a hospital where they pound safe sleep into their heads. Like, this is what you do. This is what you do. This is what you do. But we go over it again. And I tell them, I know you've heard this, but this is really important. Alone on your back in a crib. And then I tell them the things that are not alone on a back in your crib. A boppy. The car seat if you're not in the car. A swing. The dock-a-tot, which is an evil, evil creation. I go over all the things that are not safe sleep. And then we talk about, this should be the most anti-Pottery Barn kid, you know, setup you can see. Nothing in that crib other than baby, a blanket, thin blanket, one, and a pacifier if you choose to use one. So we go over safe sleep stuff. We go over, please do not bed share. Please do not put the baby down on a couch. We go over that repeatedly. We go over car seat. Yes, you have to be in a car seat. It has to be rear facing, back seat every single time you go in that car. My other third, you know, bare minimum is, what does sick look like? So what is the magic number, 100.4, and what does sick look like between now and you see your pediatrician? I need you to understand what sick looks like. So your baby is, they feel really warm and you take their temperature and they are 100.4. That's an easy one. But other things, you know, babies don't have a lot of ways to tell you they're sick. So you got to kind of read between the lines. They're really, really irritable. And you have done all the calming things that you would normally do. You have fed and you have changed and you have rocked and you have swayed and you have sung. And you've still got a baby who is just persistently not settling. Alternatively, you got a baby who's super sleepy and lethargic and won't wake up. You get to sleep through one feed. You don't get to sleep through two. You are looking a whole lot more yellow. You are vomiting. And I don't mean spitting up. I mean vomiting, especially if it is green or bloody. Or if you are having just frank diarrhea. So those are the things, that's my bare minimum three. Now, often I would generally with first-time parents include, you know, bathing, cord care, cert care. Some of that they've already gotten from the nursing staff and are comfortable just kind of moving on. We do talk some about, you know, voiding and stooling patterns, particularly if it's going to be a day or two before they see their pediatrician and, you know, they're breastfeeding. We talk a little bit about jaundice and things to kind of look for with that. But I honestly, the thing that I think is not in the AAP criteria is warning them that babies are miserable, gaseous little malcontents. They really hate the whole world. Beginning at about 3 weeks, or about 3 months old, they hate the whole world. I don't want to sleep. I don't want to sleep on my back. I want to be held. I'm going to draw up my legs and scream. I'm going to burp. I'm going to fart. I'm going to do it all night long. And every breastfeeding mom thinks it's something she's eating. And every formula feeding mom thinks it's the baby formula. And it's babies being babies. They are adorably cute, lovely, miserable little people. And I usually say it like that because typically, you know, parents kind of chuckle. But they're not super happy people. And I think them understanding that your baby being, this is how babies are. This is just baby personality. And this is normal and it will get better, but it's going to take a while. There are a reason that generally speaking, it takes two people to have a child because raising a child this is not a single player sport by any stretch. Recruit help. Your partner, your mother, their mother, the neighbor across the street, a night nanny, get some help. You've got to get, this is again, not a single player sport. And for my families, who I actually find in some ways the most fun and probably the most anxious families are the families who have, you know, they're professionals, they've waited into their 30s to have their children, and they've read every book about how this is supposed to go and this is what you're supposed to do. And, you know, they get convinced there's a right way and a wrong way. despite the fact that most of parenting is just parenting choices. But if I don't do it the right way, they're not going to go into Harvard or whatever. And I tell them, I say, listen, you know, you've got a lot of resources. You've got a good pediatrician. You're going to see them in a couple days. But in the middle of the night, when you are sitting up worrying that whatever decision you're making, hey, there's a right answer and a wrong answer, and you're going to choose the wrong one, I want you to take a deep breath. And I want you to say to yourself, younger and dumber people than me have figured this out. I have very, very young girls, I mean, not even grown women sometimes, who keep their children alive. And again, this is generally parents who are sort of, they've put a lot of, becoming a parent has been a very conscious decision, oftentimes a very long path for them, and they want to do it right. And they just got to understand that there's a lot of different ways to do it right. Feed them, love them, don't shake them.
And I was about to say, you said three things offline beforehand that you should repeat again for our listeners here.
Yeah, the must-dos of parenting are feed them, love them, and don't shake them. If you can get those three things, we can get you through the rest. You've got partners in this. Your pediatrician is your partner. They are there to help you.
At home, we have said feed the baby and love the baby, and we're good. We didn't include don't shake the baby. That might have been assumed, but I'm glad that we said that out loud. So feed the baby, love the baby, don't shake the baby.
Well, thank you so much for spending tonight with us. I learned a whole bunch. I probably should have known some of this stuff a long time ago, but I'm glad I learned it now, and I'm very sure our listeners learned a lot too. I appreciate you and everything you've done tonight. I don't know if I have anything else. Will you come back again for some other newborn stuff or maybe some other pediatric hospital stuff?
If I have not exhausted everything I know, I would be happy to, guys. It was a great, I enjoyed spending this evening with you, and thanks for having me.
And is there anything you'd like to plug? Anything our listeners should go to that you wanted to check out? Anything that we can offer the group?
PHM Anaheim in July. Come on out there, guys. It should be a good show. I'm very excited for PHM.
Will this episode be out by then, or will it be out afterwards?
Afterwards, but that's okay. You know,
we'll point about all the PHMs in the future as well.
We're at PHM 2026. Be there, be square.
Well, thank you again.
Thanks for having me, guys.
This has been another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids!
Get show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our producer for this episode, Dr. Callie Marshall, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter/X and Instagram and Blue Sky, which is mostly Denise Cruz. I'm Sam Mazur.
And I'm Callie Marshall.
And this has been Chris the Chi Manchu. Thank you and good night. And for those who've made it to the end, you're going to be blessed by another poem written by AI. This one's actually based on what I was taught when I was an intern, how to give the discharge speech from the newborn unit. This is called The Backs of Life. Back to sleep, alone and flat. No pillows, blankets, or toys, or that. A fitted sheet, a safe, firm bed. Keep dangers far from baby's head. Backward facing in the car, until they're bigger, stronger far. The safest spot, the middle rear, with harness snug from ear to ear. Bring them back if fever spikes, 100.4 where danger hikes. Watch their skin for yellow hue that spreads from face to body too. 8 feedings, 6 wet diapers mean your baby's system's working clean. Back away from crowded spaces, keep germs from precious baby faces. When in doubt, don't hold back tears. We're here to help through joys and tears. The backs of life will keep them sound until your next check comes around. Not too bad. See you guys.